Please be advised that this episode does have content that some may find distressing.
Hello, I'm Jenny and welcome to episode 2 of It's Murder Up North. Thank you so much for joining me as I reflect on crimes that occur in the north of England, from the infamous to the obscure. You can now listen to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean and Spotify. Please help by liking, subscribing, sharing and leaving comments and reviews. I also welcome any case suggestions you may have. Before I proceed with the episode, I want to thank those who have offered me support and encouragement. Starting a podcast is a nerve-wracking experience, but you have given me the confidence to face the challenge. So I say thank you to Joseph, my first overseas supporter, all the way in New Mexico. Thank you so much for subscribing to my YouTube channel as well. I appreciate your kind words and hope you continue to enjoy my podcast. Thank you to the members of the It's Murder Up North Facebook group, with a special mention to Lily, Teresa, James and Gemma. I also want to thank Adam at the True Crime UK podcast. If you haven't checked it out yet, please do. Adam and his show are both amazing. Please also check out Skinwalker, a fantastic new podcast covering Scottish true crime. Jess is doing a brilliant job. And if nothing else, you have to listen just for his accent. Now let's get this episode started. On February the 12th, 1993, no one could possibly have foreseen the atrocities that were to happen to James Bulger after he left his mother's side whilst she was buying meat in the butcher's shop. The curious 2-year-old wandered out of A.R. Tim's Butchers and turned right onto the concourse of the Strand Shopping Centre in Bootle. Passers-by didn't think anything of the toddler following 2 older boys through the shopping centre. And as the trio took the exit towards the Leeds-Liverpool Canal, witnesses could be forgiven for thinking it was 2 children looking after their little brother as they walked along hand in hand. After all, these 10-year-old boys were just children. After James's murder, these 10-year-olds would not be seen as innocent children. They would be responsible for committing the most horrific crime, one which to this day still shocks and divides opinion. This crime is often used to argue the case of nature versus nurture. It is impossible to comprehend how such evil can be committed by anyone, especially 2 individuals who were just 7 years older than James. Even now, nearly 30 years later, there are still so many questions regarding what happened. 18 months before that fateful February day, a fight broke out in a school playground. A group of children crowded around as 2 boys traded blows. Swiftly, the fight was brought to an end by the intervention of teachers. But this was a birth of a deadly friendship, born out of violence. This was when John Venables and Robert Thompson first found mutual respect for each other. There have been so many theories regarding what turned these boys into killers. Was it to do with their upbringing? Were they influenced by violent video games and films? Was it an act of misdirected anger born out of jealousy? Or were they just born evil? It'd be interesting to know your thoughts. Like in episode 1, when I discussed Denise being haunted by what-ifs, it will become apparent that there are so many people who will be asking themselves the same question as we delve deeper into this case. First of all, let's take a closer look at the 2 10-year-old boys. Robert Thompson was the 5th of 7 children. He was born on August the 23rd, 1982. When Thompson was just 5 years old, his father abandoned the family, leaving Thompson's mum, Anne, to raise the 7 children alone. Anne struggled to cope with her husband leaving and found it difficult to look after her children while she was fighting her own demons of depression, alcoholism and suicidal tendencies. Thompson grew up in a deprived area of Liverpool. His home life was unruly. The siblings were physically violent. They would assault and torture each other. Perhaps due to this, Thompson spent most of his time on the streets. Lacking any discipline or guidance in his life, he often played truant from school, choosing to partake in shoplifting and other antisocial behaviour. Robert Thompson's moral compass was definitely not aligned. But when questioned and assessed after the murder, he was found to understand the moral implications of his crime. So can we truly blame his upbringing? People are quick to blame his mother. However, I'd like you for one moment to imagine being in her shoes. Abandoned by her husband to raise 7 children alone. Living in poverty, struggling day by day to get the essentials. Fighting depression and suffering with suicidal thoughts. I am not saying that we should feel sorry for Thompson, or that these circumstances make a murderer. There are so many examples of children who have been raised in worse conditions who go on to live successful and law-abiding lives. John Venables was also born in August 1982, on the 13th. He came from a broken home, however, his father was still a key figure in his life. Though separated, the parents worked hard to create a stable upbringing for their children. John's siblings both suffered from learning difficulties, and due to this, understandably, they received more of their parents' attention. To the 10-year-old John, did this leave him in his immature mind feeling resentment towards them? Did he misbehave in order to get attention? Venables did encounter issues at school as well. He was hyperactive and difficult to manage. He also showed a violent side when he attempted to strangle another student. He came from an affectionate home. His parents were working class, and they strove to ensure their children were both loved and disciplined. When Venables got into trouble for skipping school, his father began dropping him off and picking him up to ensure his attendance improved. They tried to keep their son on the right path, and they thought it was working. It's hard to see how John's home life could have influenced his actions. Although he showed some behaviour that, in hindsight, was concerning, at the time you couldn't have predicted that he would be part of something so awful. Was he so filled with resentment and so deprived of attention that he took it out on James? A couple of weeks before James was taken, it has been reported that Thompson and Venables had attempted to take another child, but they did not succeed. The two boys met up on the 12th of February 1993 and decided to skip school. They headed to the Strand Shopping Centre, where they loitered, misbehaving and stealing from shops. They are seen trying to coerce a child who had become separated from his mother. This child was about 4 years old, but fortunately the mother stepped in and took the child away. I don't know what you think. To me, this sounds like they had some intention of kidnapping a young child and had been planning it for at least a couple of weeks. And unless one of the boys admits it, we will never know if hurting a child was part of the plan. When James left the butcher's shop, the two boys were easily able to coerce the trusting toddler to follow them. 2-year-olds don't always see danger. And for all the people who saw the trio that day, it's understandable they didn't see ill intentions either. That leads us to the what ifs. What if the mother, whose child was talking to the boys earlier, had gotten suspicious and reported the incident? What if security had caught the two boys shoplifting? Or questioned 2 10-year-olds hanging around in a shopping centre why they weren't at school? And what if someone had sensed that something was not right and had stopped the 3 boys and questioned them? Hindsight is a wonderful thing. James would be taken on foot 2.5 miles away from the Strand Shopping Centre. I've just picked my 2-year-old up from preschool. She only goes for half a day and it's a couple of minutes walk away from our house, but she insists on being carried home because she is so tired from the busy day she's had. So imagine little James. He had been walking around a shopping centre for a couple of hours, now being made to walk a further 2.5 miles. The boys led James along the canal towpath. He was crying and asking for his mummy. At one point, Thompson claimed that Venables threatened to push James into the water. Further along the towpath, they dropped the toddler and he landed on his head, resulting in a large cut. The boys attempted to hide this by putting James's blue hood up. As James was taken through the various streets, numerous people saw him with the two boys. Some reported seeing him very distressed, while others stated he was playing and laughing with his companions. It's easy to understand why people did not intervene at these sightings. It actually reminds me a little bit of when I was younger. On my way home from school with my older sister, I would complain about being tired. I would cry. I would scream and cause a fuss. She'd get impatient with me and drag me by my hand to get me home. Nobody ever stopped to ask her why or what she was doing. I guess when it comes to it being children, you cannot see evil intentions. My sister never meant me harm, and people rightfully presumed she was my sister getting me home. But perhaps that's also what the people who witnessed Venables, Thompson, and Bulger thought that day. Some witnesses claimed to have seen the boys physically assaulting James. One witness saw Robert Thompson kick James in the ribs, and others stated they observed the boys punching and kicking the toddler. But they didn't do anything to stop it. I personally find this hard to understand. I would like to think that if I saw such behaviour, I would stop to help, but I wasn't there on the day this happened. I didn't witness it, so who am I to say what I would have done differently? People question why these witnesses didn't react to the situation. However, we have to consider they do not have the information we do. Their sightings of the trio were fleeting. These witnesses did not know the circumstances and had no way of knowing that they could have prevented a murder. I can imagine that these people live with the regret every day of their lives, that they form another what if. What if someone had stopped the boys? But the thing is, people did stop the boys. They questioned them about James. Some even told Thompson and Venables to take James to the police station after they claimed he was lost. One lady even offered to take James to the police station for them, but tragically, she was unable to get somebody to look after her baby. I think instead of blaming the people who did nothing, perhaps we should ask why the boys didn't own up to taking James. Why didn't they hand him over to one of the adults who stopped them, or leave him in one of the two shops they visited, or even take him to the police station like they had been advised? I don't believe it was out of fear of reprisal. They had already told people that James was a lost boy, to take him all that way with all the opportunities. But the alternative is not worth considering because it terrifies me. Did they intend to hurt James all along? With opportunities to safely return James to his mother quickly fading, the 10-year-old took James onto a railway line just 200 feet away from Walton Police Station. They were that close to somewhere they could have taken James. He could have been reunited with his family, and I would not have to talk about what happened next. The boys tell varying accounts of what happened and who did what, but to me it doesn't matter. In my mind, they committed this crime together. At roughly 5:45, as they walked along the railway line, they began to throw stones at James. Thompson claimed each time James fell, he would stand back up again and they would pelt him with more stones. While at the Strand Shopping Centre, they had stolen some blue spray paint, which they proceeded to spray into James's face, getting it on their clothes in the process. They then continued their brutal assault on James, using their feet, hands, and rocks. He suffered roughly 42 injuries during the attack. The boys then found a 22-pound iron bar nearby and hit James about the head with it, causing several skull fractures. It is claimed that Venables then filled James's mouth with batteries. The whole thing is senseless. James was also stripped and sexually assaulted. However, both boys denied this taking place. And in one final callous act, the toddler's lifeless body was placed on the railway tracks and would be struck by a train shortly after. After they committed the murder, the two killers headed home in silence. Meanwhile, just 200 feet away from her son's lifeless body, Denise sat in an interrogation room at the police station, not knowing where her baby was as night drew in. This was the same police station that Thompson and Venables could have taken James to. It took just 4 minutes for James to be led from the shopping centre, 55 minutes till his killers attacked him on the railway line. When a child is taken, there is the all-important golden hour in which the child needs to be located. As each hour passes, chances of that child being found alive diminish. Tragically, James was gone before the investigation fully begun. 2 days after he was taken, his body was found by two teenagers on the railway track. And 2 weeks after this, his killers were arrested. Police had records of who had not attended school that day, and they also received a tip-off from a witness who claimed they saw blue paint on the boy's clothing on the day of James's murder. The murder and subsequent trial made international news. It was, of course, a shocking event, but it was sensationalised by how young the killers were. The age of criminal responsibility in the UK was 10 at the time, and as the killers had turned 10 just 6 months prior to the crime, they were tried as adults. It was decided that their identities would be concealed until the conclusion of the case. The trial lasted 17 days. The boys were found guilty of murder, but their sentence would anger the country. Due to their age, they each got an 8-year maximum sentence. The public outrage led to this being increased to 15 years. In June 2001, the killers were released from prison after serving just 7 years. I know, it's shocking. 7 years for murdering a child. Public would be angered when a court ruling gave the killers anonymity for the rest of their lives. Since his release, Robert Thompson, the boy who was labelled cold, emotionless, and the dominant perpetrator of the crime, has pretty much disappeared. Controversially, he claimed being imprisoned for the murder was the best thing that could have happened to him, as in prison he got discipline, structure, and a good education. He is reported to be living in the northwest of England with his partner, who apparently knows his identity. John Venables, on the other hand, has been arrested for breaching his parole. He was found to have in his possession over 1,000 explicit images of children and a book titled How to Have Sex with Little Girls. He was jailed for just over 3 years for this offence. It ignited a debate on his right to anonymity. And in 2019, after much campaigning to have their son's killer's anonymity removed, a court ruling denied the notion, claiming it was not in the interest of either the killer or the public for his identity to be known. There is a real fear that if his identity was revealed, he would be at risk of retribution. This case has stayed with people because of its brutality. The fact these perpetrators were the youngest killers in the UK in over 250 years, and the controversy surrounding the sentences and subsequent issuing of new identities and lifelong anonymity. I think this case changed our perception of the things that go on around us. It made us a little more suspicious. The day James died, the innocence of a nation died as well. I admit I was surprised by claims that Thompson is a reformed character, especially after he was labelled the one who was truly evil. Could this be proof that people can be reformed? And that a lot of what drove Thompson to commit the murder is due to his upbringing. Perhaps it is evidence that how we look after a young person's mind can affect who they become as adults. Then, how does that explain Venables and what he became? Out of the two boys, he was the one who came from a stable family and was believed to be the submissive one. During his sentence, he was offered the same opportunities as Thompson, yet he is the one who's been returned to prison. It makes me question, was he the one who was evil? There are so many victims in this case. Of course, James's family will always have to live with this. And the witnesses who in hindsight wish they could have done more, police officers who investigated not only the horrific murder of a toddler, but to be confronted with the perpetrators who were just 7 years older than the victim. When you listen to the interrogation tapes, you appreciate what an amazing job the investigators did. Let's face it, there is no handbook for interrogating 10-year-old murderers. We will never fully understand why these boys did what they did. What about the parents of the killers? In cases like this, I always wonder how they feel. Everyone has ambitions for their children. They want them to go on to have amazing careers and have good lives. Nobody envisions their child becoming a murderer. In this case, the parents were vilified. Their lives were judged. I'm not saying that they were perfect parents, and I could never defend their children. But I cannot imagine how they coped with the fact that their flesh and blood were responsible for something so unforgivable. Two more victims in this case were the two teenage boys who discovered James's body on the railway line. Both boys struggled to come to terms with what they saw that day, and this led them down a dark path of drug and alcohol abuse, and resulted in them having criminal records. It is highly likely they suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and that they turned to alcohol and drugs to numb the pain. The final and most important person in this case is James Bulger. I sincerely hope that episode 1 helped you to see him as James the boy, rather than James the murder victim. To close, I want to repeat a quote from Denise that I included in episode 1, as I believe this is how we should remember James. He was real, fizzing with life. James lit up a room. He was never grumpy. There were no tantrums. And he wasn't naughty. He was a cheeky little ray of sunshine. Thank you so much for joining me for episode 2 of It's Murder Up North. You can find my podcast on Podbean, iTunes and Spotify. Please join my Facebook group, It's Murder Up North Podcast. You can also get in touch on Twitter at JennySenior4. And check out It's Murder Up North's YouTube channel. As always, your support means the world to me. Please like, review and subscribe. And don't forget to leave comments. I look forward to reading them. I am currently writing the next episode, which hopefully will be coming out soon. So in the meantime, keep an eye on those shadows.